is that Chris?
Hi, it's Steph Barnes from QLDC. I'm just at the Mount St John's Special Event Change hearing. I'm just wondering if you have on the
Mr. Rossiter, it's Jane Corner, the chair.
Hello.
Hello. Oh, you speak loudly. There are three of us here, so we're going to go through the questions one at a time, and Commissioner Dimery will be first.
Okay.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I've got a question, some technical bit of detail about your calculations on the trip rate. And I think in your letter it refers to coach use being quite predominant, and then later in the goal strategy report discussion about people traveling to the new parking bay golf resort for golf visitors, and I was just wondering, wouldn't golfers be more likely to be self drive and therefore increase the vehicles per day?
The question's not coming through very clearly.
So the question is, it's about that you've talked about heavy reliance on coach use, but I'm questioning whether the golf is more likely to be self-drive given the golf specific going to other resorts in the area, and whether your practice is in.
Certainly in terms of a resort centre, we've separated out the traffic generation for the golf activity from the general accommodation. If they were combined, there would be a reduction in the total traffic generation on the site. But the golf course generation has calculated, we've based it on the number of rounds of golf that we would anticipate, and assume that all of that vehicle movement is straight onto the state highway.
Okay. Sorry, just I thought I read somewhere else about referring to use of coaches, but I can't quite remember that one.
4.2. No. That was in reference to the hotel and the hotel accommodation. Hotel accommodation, or the hotel traffic generation rates, vary widely with the hotel location and how they're being used. Then this sort of location, I would expect quite a high percentage of self-drive, but equally I could see there being a reasonable portion of coach travel or group travellers stopping here as somewhere different.
Okay. Yeah, I just was confused by the comment there, but we talked about a high proportion of the visitors today traveling by coach, and I thought that having the well to jam, they might be more likely to be self-drive.
I think a lot will depend upon what the destination is for the individual travellers, whether they are there for the golf or for the other activities that they will be able to do in the future. Yeah, whether it's the ski field, for example, in the winter, where you might expect more coach travel in than self-drive.
Thank you. Turning up your tables 2 and 3 on page 5, has this factored in trip generation to the commercial development? I understand it's not a huge amount of development, but I can't see it in here.
I deliberately excluded the commercial element on there because the traffic generation we're looking at here is the generation that would be on the state highway, on Cardrona Valley Road, rather than what would occur sort of within the resort. So any commercial development there is really targeting internal movements, or if it's a ski field activity, that's vehicle movements that already exist rather than are new to the network.
Okay.
everything on this table is things that would be new to the road network.
Okay, we heard earlier this morning from the Gulf Strategy paper, more I think it was, that this type of facility could attract people to the restaurant even if they weren't playing golf or to other commercial facilities, so I'm not sure what the portion that could be, but whether it was relevant.
I think it would depend upon the nature of the commercial activities that were established in the area. I had only been thinking in terms of the small sort of shops and facilities to support the golf course or the ski field rather than other activities.
Okay. I was a little bit confused by the discussion around the site visit yesterday. We came up the existing access, and in your letter it talks about the access moving further north from what's under the operative plan change. I was just wondering, it seems quite close to that corner, and I'm sure you have considered that you consider that it's 100 kilometres
The issue with the access road in the existing under the existing structure plan is that it is south of a road to the snow farm activities or to the Gully Road, the formed version of it. That means that if we generate more traffic with the development of this resort, if you left it as shown on the existing structure plan, the right turn movements from both sides, going into both sides of the road, would overlap, which would be very dangerous. So what we've had to do with the revised structure plan is move the new access road north of the existing intersection, the existing formation of Tui Gully Road, so that the right turns don't overlap.
Okay, and do you think that will make sufficient room with a 100 kilometre speed limit for, you're talking about modifications for people to follow, but you're confident there's enough room to design that at a location?
Yeah, I had a look and did a preliminary intersection design, and there is adequate sight distance for the speed limit for the two intersections, and have right turn bays formed for both the new development or the plan change area, and also a right turn bay formed for Tui Gully Road.
Same lines, but have you given consideration to whether you share the entranceway to the Cadrona Valley Road, after the Cadrona Access Road, rather than realigning your own access road? Is that a possibility? That would go through the Buckley Cemetery. Is that a possibility or not? I'm asking a question in the context of the traffic movements on the whole road.
I think this location gives you a better access than the existing ski field access in terms of sight distance. I'm not quite sure when you just referred to the cemetery area, I'm not sure which area that is on.
Sorry, if you look at the entranceway to the Cadrona Ski Field Road, there's a section 6 there. I'm thinking just past 6, you could cut across that little valley there through where the initials 5B are. Is there any possibility of doing that? Maybe there's not.
I don't see why you wouldn't be able to, in terms of a physical access road. It's not an option that I looked at when I was on site. But as I recall from going up the ski field access road, it does climb quite steeply up to that first sort of hairpin bend. I'm not sure what the contours are across the 5 feet area, but I would imagine it would be possible to form a road from there.
Yeah, I was just looking at them, but perhaps the safety issue, because the two main routes here, you know, sort of quite have been a couple of hundred metres apart.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's okay.
From that safety point of view, I don't see that as an issue. The separation is enough to allow you to put appropriate signage in for both. And it means also that you've got a clear distinction between the two activities. So one is very clearly a ski field access and the other is a resort access.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Thank you very much.
Mr. Rosser, my question relates to the link road. Do you know what I mean by that? The ski field link shown on the structure plan there?
I've got structure plan in front of me.
Yeah, so this is the road that goes from the northern part of the site up to the ski field road.
Yeah, yes.
Just some questions around that intersection, particularly for those coming down the mountain and having to turn right into the link road.
Yes.
I don't know if you've ever been there on a day like we were yesterday in the inversion cloud. You can't see anything. So, and it's quite common to come down that road from the mountain after skiing and to be completely coated in dust. You can't see anything in either. So I'm just asking you about, have you thought about that and the traffic safety implications of that? Because people do hurdle down that last stretch quite fast.
As I recall, that section of road is fairly wide and I am aware that people do travel quite quickly on that bit because the road straightens up. I don't see there being too much of an issue. The ski field access road has sufficient width, which it is quite wide at that point, but may need some additional widening, and it will be signposted. But I don't think there would be too much of a problem. At the end of the day, with people coming down, there will be very few people going up as well.
Okay, so it's just you'd have to slow down to turn, of course. And if you can't see ahead of you, you may end up someone right behind you. It's not so much crossing the traffic I'm concerned about, it's more the traffic coming down the hill behind the person trying to turn right.
But enough room and visibility, even allowing for a slightly mucky car, for indicators still to be visible. While it's not possible to force drivers to follow at safe distances, it is encouraged. But I don't see an issue with that. But there is that section of road, as I recall, is quite straight, so it should be quite clear that when someone's going to be turning right, that they're indicating they'd be moving over towards the centre of the road to do so.
Okay. Well, that was all I had, but the other questions I had have been asked already. Thank you. So, you're free to go.
Thank you.
Thank you for making yourself available today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Give us a GS of hazards.
GS of. Out of it.
Out of the road. As you say, the passing, just while you're on that last question, you're asking the commissioners that I think that there's no change to the location of that road.
No. It's just particularly accused of people who are standing there and unable to see anything.
Pass.
Summary of evidence. I undertook site mapping and observations of the ground stations for the purpose of the geotechnical assessments, and this was undertaken to provide further information to support the current climate change request. A review of Wood and Thompson's geological hazard report and previously completed testing data across the site was completed to provide further information for the assessment. It should be noted that the issued documents were based on broad-scale geomorphic mapping and assessments of previously completed investigations. Further detailed assessments to accompany future resource consent applications will be required to confirm nearly suitable final platforms and other sites of concern that may arise. This is standard practice in many areas of Queenstown Lakes District at the detailed design and construction phase of development. The attached geotechnical report has been peer-reviewed by senior GSL staff members and Stocker, senior water engineer, and Fraser Wilson, senior engineering geologist, prior to issue. Based upon my preliminary findings from the site assessment, along with standard GSL practice of reviewing investigation data were applicable to nearby sites as part of the depth study, I've reached the following conclusions in respect of the site. The site is expected to comprise alluvial band deposits and alluvial deposits, i.e. silt, sand and gravel, with overlying topsoil and loose silt. A trace of the active Cadrona fault has been identified approximately 300 metres to the west of the proposed development area. The average return period for earthquakes on the Cadrona fault is 5,000 to 10,000 years. Thus, the risk of strong ground shaking or surface rupture is considered very low. The main seismic risk in the region is from an earthquake on the Alpine Fault, which runs down the west coast of South Island, which has an estimated 30% probability in the next 50 years. This would subject the whole Wanaka region, including the site, to strong ground shaking. In terms of natural hazards, the Queenstown Lakes District Council and Otago Regional Council maps have identified alluvial bands and active fault hazards within and nearby the proposed site. Further to this, geological mapping has identified shallow landslides and mining hazards in the site. After a review of Lloyd and Thompson's geological and hydrological investigations and assessments of our own field observations, it was concluded that there is negligible risk to the site from flooding and debris flow due to the deeply incised nearby creeks and the lack of recent alluvial fan deposits. Active landslides on the steep slopes to the north and south of Homestead Creek and to the west of the proposed development area were observed. These are considered to be slow creeping landslides and development in these areas is to be avoided. Historic mining activity has been identified in the northeast area of the site. However, this is not expected to pose any geotechnical implications on the fan change area. That is subject to local verification and checking of fans. Liquefaction potential under seismic shaking is considered relatively low on the site due to the combination of the deep static water table and coarse granular deposits extending to depth. Future residential development on the site would not be impeded by any geotechnical issues observed on the site, apart from some areas north and south of Homestead Creek and to the west of the proposed development area due to landslides. Also, areas in the immediate vicinity of the Cadrona fault scarp, which is approximately 300 metres to the west of the proposed development. The site investigation to date has been preliminary only. Future construction close to these areas will need to be assessed in detail on a case-by-case basis, and specific assessments will be required required and localised mitigation measures may be necessary. The site overall is considered suitable for residential use, subject to standard site-specific engineering solutions applicable at the detailed design phase of future development and construction. And the geological conditions and associated risks are acceptable for the intended use of the site, subject to the caveats mentioned above. As noted in the reports, detailed investigations will be required to finalise specific engineering requirements for future building works. Thank you.
So, now the attachment, commissioners, is the, what was in the original report, plus the two appendices, which got listed and have been handed out.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you. I was hoping you could just expand on the annual paragraph 10, you just said that future construction close to the areas may be detailed. Do I take that to mean all of the activity areas in the maintained area, or is it some of them?
The areas where where you would need to do... Overall, generally, the buildings on this, building locations on the site will require site-specific investigations, i.e. test pitting, penetrometer testing, liquefaction testing, and so forth, which is just standard for building foundations. So that will apply to the existing proposed buildings, but there are specific areas, like the areas adjacent to Homestead Creek on the banks of the on the sides of the gully and at the with no proposed buildings at the moment, but it would be potential issues in there, and also at the extreme western end of the site where you've got landsliding and you also got the trace of the Cadrona fault, which you would want, obviously you want to avoid landslide areas and you don't want to build right on top of fault traces. So those areas would have got issues. But the areas within the proposed development at the moment are relatively straightforward.
Okay.
My question is just around your comments about the offline fault line. Is there any further you can add to that? Because that's obviously the biggest risk the region faces.
Well, the offline fault is a major problem in this whole district. And as you may be aware, that they're setting up a civil defence organisation at the moment called AF8, which is specifically to deal with the consequences of an offline fault event. And that was... The estimated probability is 30% in the next 50 years, but it could happen tomorrow. The consequences of that would be that this area would be subject to possibly up to 5 minutes of strong shaking.
The whole district here?
The whole district, the whole Wanaka, Queenstown, the whole of the central, this Queenstown Lakes district. And that is likely to cause major problems, particularly in Queenstown.
That would be an understatement, I would suggest. That would be an understatement.
Yes. No, it would be a physical disaster. It would also be an economic disaster because the West Coast is likely to, all the access roads would be cut off. The tourist industry is in serious trouble if that appears.
As I read your statement, the key thing really is this, this affects everybody.
It affects the whole of this district. The closer you get to the alpine fault, the more intense the shaking. And if you're on elevated ground, on peaks, the steep ground, you get amplification of the shaking. It's like the Port Hills and in Christchurch. So topography affects the effects as well. But the other issue, of course, is liquefaction. And for liquefaction, you need loose silts and sands, and you need a high water table. You need wet material. And in relation to this site, the water table is deep, and so the issues are not, there isn't, it doesn't appear to be any significant issues based on the test bidding that we've carried out and our geological observations.
Well, I thought thanks for the clarification. That's quite important. That's quite important.
Yes, absolutely. But we would certainly still do, in the course of individual site investigations for buildings, we would check that the liquefaction risk was not there.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. It's just part of the standard process.
Josh, just another question on Appendix A, Figure 3. You know, I'm just trying to find it for the life, but I can't find it. But I had a question mark beside it, and I wasn't quite sure if it was a question mark. Appendix A, Figure 3. I just had a question mark, right? It was in a very unusual spot.
Okay.
Oh,
okay.
Oh, there it
is. Okay.
It's under the key, a line, and it's got active fault location across.
Okay, that's based on the current QLDC hazard mapping. We have subsequently, if you look in the Warden Thompson's report right at the very back of the document, which has been appended, Warden did a very detailed assessment of that fault.
Right.
And he's got the location to show it on that plan, which is actually figure in his report, figure 3A.
Right.
And that's, and you can see it's marked F, a vertical line running down through that area marked F. It's that feature there.
Okay.
So that is around about approximately 300 metres west of the proposed development.
Okay. And that's a sufficient distance.
Oh, yeah. But the thing about that fault is that the return period on the active fault is 5,000 to 10,000 years. Mm-hmm. So the probability of that rupturing in the next 50 years is extremely low. The much greater risk is from the Alpine fault.
Sure.
And this fault, if you project it down the valley, it runs right down the valley. It runs the other side of Mount Iron, and it runs right through the middle of Albertown.
See you later.
You really wanted to know that.
I can't lie to
So I don't think the risk is any greater up here than it is out there.
Well, thanks for that. I
appreciate that. It's such a long return period. The big worry here is something that's going to happen in the next 50 years, which we know pretty much almost certainly the Alpine fault will rupture in the next 100, and there's a 30% chance in the next 50. And that's the one we really need to engineer for in a serious way, because that's the major risk.
How have you engineered
for that? Well, in the foundations, you've got to be sure that the ground isn't going to liquefy for a start. So there's various ways of mitigating liquefaction which have been developed in the course of the work in Christchurch following the earthquake. One method is to, if you've got a moderate risk of liquefaction, you can place a compacted gravel pad over the building footprints, and that will reduce the deformation associated with potential liquefaction. If you have high risk of liquefaction, then you require specific remedial actions, which might be piling quite sophisticated, expensive systems. So there's those issues. Then there's the structural engineering issues, of course, which the structural engineers deal with, and it's not our field. But it's possible to mitigate these risks.
I just had a couple of questions, and maybe for me to relate back to legal tests. So this probably sounds like a ridiculous, stupid question, but I need to ask it anyway. 30% is a high probability.
yes, I think that's right. There's a high probability that that fault is going to rupture. And it's taken seriously, obviously seriously, by the government, because they've funded a special group, civil defence group, to study the effects of that. So it's well recognised by geologists and engineers as a major problem for South Island as a whole, not just for this district, but for the whole South Island really, and also Wellington.
The second question I asked this of Mr. Goldsmith earlier, well, I think it might be Mr. Stella coming, but one of them. There's a new insertion of the RMA that has been made about significant risks from natural hazards,
yes,
which is a matter of national importance we need to take account of now.
Yes.
I understood your evidence, putting aside the Alpine fault point, I'm understanding everything else to say there is no significant risk of natural hazards. Is that right?
Yes, the other hazards that which are delineated in the report are flooding and debris flows, which have been, Ruin Thompson has, in his report, has studied that quite intensely, and our own hydrologist, Hank Stocker, who's a very experienced man, has looked at that, and he concurs with the conclusions that Ruin came to. Which are essentially that there's negligible risk. And the reason is that the both Homestead Creek and Freckles Creek are very deeply entrenched below the level of the alluvial fan that the bill proposed. And as a consequence, flooding and debris flows coming down that creek are extremely unlikely to spill out and go over the edge. Yeah. Yes. So there's that issue. There's the issue of mining, underground mining. There is a mining tunnel which is shown on our plan. If you look at figure two, there's an old coal mining tunnel which is outside the, well, it's to the east of the development area. It is, coal mining tunnels are always potential problem because they, particularly in strong earthquakes, they may collapse, so you might have a problem with subsidence at the surface. The mining tunnel is along the geological contact between the alluvial fan gravels, which cap the lightning for surface, and the underlying gravel formations. So it's conceivable, and that contact runs around the side of the valley, along the side of the slopes of the Cadrana, of the Homestead Creek. So you can actually see the contact being dotted in along there. And it's possible that there may be other mines along that area. But that issue would have to be looked at in the course of detailed investigations for buildings in those specific areas. But it's very unlikely that there's any mining under the bulk of the terrace area. It'll be along that contact on the side there where they can get in. They mine along. The gold's concentrated on that geological contact. So it's conceivable that there may be some other mines. We haven't found them in the course of geological mapping. But it is conceivable there could be there. That would have to be looked at in the course of the buildings that are proposed in that immediate area that need to be looked at. So what other issues? I think we've covered the protection. Covered the issue of the seismic hazard issues, the protection. Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. Thank you.
Okay, that was all I had. Thank you very much.
Yes, Mr. Heller, the excuse.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that was driving away. Right,
so
Mr. Brown's turn now.
Oh, Mr. Morton. Mr. Morton, probably at this stage.
Grab your folder. Just in case you wanted to address the change, we just printed off a copy of the old structure plan. Get a copy, then you might be able to get off the system. There's no particular brief, Mr. Morton, commissioners, but you can get comments about the nation in response to what's happened and then answer any questions.
Okay. I thought I'd probably just talk to this plan here, it's a colour. So the original plan came today, being achieving anything, and as I talked earlier, there's a lot of consultation and coming up around the community between the community and the planner or something like that. And in many ways, it moved from a very difficult zone to something which was pretty constructive. As we talked about, it was in 2011, and just briefly traversing the crash of things, basically put things on hold for a few years, and then in 2014-15 started really looking at things. Perhaps one point I should make, when you've got a large development such as this, it's compared to a small one, if you've got a relatively brief window of good economic times, you can actually get a small project underway and may finish it during that time. But when you've got something as large as this, with substantial effort costs like a wastewater treatment plant and a water treatment plant and access roads and things like that, you actually need pretty good times and a view of pretty good times over quite some period of time. So that's probably the main reason why, certainly one of the reasons why development didn't occur. But it certainly occurred to me in looking at the thing and perhaps wondering why when water in Queenstown was starting to get moving, why we weren't seeing quite the activity. And Cadrona wasn't seeing activity. There was actually some business being done in Cadrona, but there was no wastewater treatment plant, so Cadrona as a whole was being constrained. And I think that was certainly leaving a feeling that people didn't want to be in Cadrona, because there wasn't actually a lot of activity happening. But certainly, it was actually the end of 2015, I think, that you met Greg Turner, and he was talking to me about golf tourism and how it was taking off. And thought about it a little bit and rang him and had a long chat. And he said, you might think that there's a lot of golf courses here, as David Moore talked about, but in fact, Greg's part of one of the things he does is he's a partner in a golf and endowed tourism business, and he said, we struggle to get tea times for people, which certainly stunned me. And I had inquiries, and in fact, certainly confirmed, colloquially talked, if you feel that wasn't the case. So it certainly occurred to me when I started looking at the project that, in fact, one of the issues, because we have been talking to hotel operators and they're just, they were a bit slow in explaining it, but it really became clear that it's not, we've created a lot of things. We've created a great visitor zone, a lot of residential zones, but we hadn't created an all year round activity. And when you came to talk to the hotel operators, they saw a wonderful winter, but they didn't see a great summer. And so I started investigating, and in February of last year, I asked Greg to come to the site, and initially I thought it was actually too high for golf, but in fact, and he told me that Russell Coutts is the golf course on the Crown Terraces, which is actually slightly higher than that. So he said, and I did some research in the web in Colorado, the golf course is 1,600 metres. He said, it's just a grass issue, you do different things. So he had a look at the site, and I didn't know whether it would work or not, and the Turners are relatively blunt people, that's all they call it as it is. And Greg said, look, don't tell me you've bought a golf course there if that's not a good idea, it's not going to work. And he said, look, that's the way I work, anyone who knows them will know that. Anyway, he came to the site, and he spent a couple of months playing around, went back, had several visits, and presented about two or three different alternatives of golf course layouts. And one of them was the 12-hole course, which I certainly wasn't aware that was a fence there, but as David, we didn't talk much with him, but recently Jack Nicklaus, for instance, opened a 12-hole golf course at the Hawkshead in Utah, and just like we've seen test cricket 50 overs, 20 overs, people's patience and time just isn't quite what it used to be. And so Greg's more than happy that a 12-hole course will operate satisfactory. And certainly, once again, I didn't want to promote a concept where we were going to rezone some residential land into a golf course that that might not work. So I mean, I probably have the most at stake than anybody. So we had some pretty long discussions about it, and he certainly will attest to the fact that that's where he thinks it's going. The European PGA Tour, I think a month ago, had a 9-hole tournament over a weekend, you know, big prize at the end, more than a knockout type tournament. So there's definitely a change to this type of format. And certainly, if you talk to people over 50, they think 18 holes is great. If you talk to younger people who are going to be older, they tend to think about, you know, that's, you know, a short game to survive. So basically we looked at various alternatives for the courses, chose a layout which we thought that he was happy with, that I thought would fit it best, and then set about trying to see whether we could fit that in and change the zone facilities if we could, and talk to Warren and Jeff, and basically tried to keep all the best things, as much as we could, out of the original zone. So we kept all the walkway connections, we changed, you know, as little of the boundaries, we pushed up the... So there was we looked at the landscape, and the biggest single factor in terms of whether we could move up was the water rates. Got some reports on that, talked to BNSB, and decided that we could push up there with a little effect, and we would be gaining a lot of open space at the bottom of the site. So that really sort of gave us the constraints, and then we really just looked internally. We kept pretty much the same philosophy of big fingers here, which tend to be low points for stormwater flows. Kept all of that, and basically we kept the idea of higher density down here and lower density there, which was the prime concept of the original plan change. One of the things we did is in the original zone, obviously as you do these sort of, having gone through two of these, which I don't want to do too many more, but they are complicated, but I think that there was a lot to cover the first time around, and we were abstract probably the right word in terms of, you know, we created a village, there was a lot of capacity in there, and I think there was a little bit more hope perhaps than reality in terms of just going into the detail, whereas this time around we were just that much more into the detail. So we moved the hotel and we were a lot more prescriptive about where the hotel would actually sit, and it sits within the amenities, the centre of the golf course, it faces north. There's about an 8-minute walk from anywhere in the village to get to the hotel, where the village centre is going to be within that 1.9 hectares. So we were really trying to maintain a bit more clarity probably about what would actually be there and how it would operate as a community, and then maintain some high density down there. So that's probably how it evolved and how we got to the plan. I think it's been relatively logical. We've obviously tested at various stages we've gone along with the relevant disciplines, if you like, in terms of the RMO process, because we knew we would be going through the sort of and it's a healthy scrutiny. I mean, one thing, I've been developing land for 30 years, and one thing, you get a bit older, I mean, there's a lot of responsibility in rezoning land, because if, you know, once you've set something there, you do want it to be pretty good. I will say one thing, this, to me, is a lot better than that one. I mean, we took a big step that time, but I think we've iterated it, and I think there's a lot more clarity about how it would actually end up. One of the things we've dealt with is in terms of probably that since Plan Change 18, which was really drafted in about 2008, so we're talking about a decade, is that generally all the subdivisions, the lot size have come down. And because we gained quite a lot of extra amenity area in here, we were happy to move, if you like, with the way the market's gone. And since we've been talking about surveys of Fortune, they've seen various iterations of subdivision where every time they've said, gosh, that seems a small lot size. But people seem to be quite happy with smaller lot sizes, there's less maintenance, there's less time, there's more activities they can do. And certainly here, where you've got a lot of amenity, I mean, we've got 22 area hectares of zone and then about 130. There's a lot of open space. You actually don't need it all on your own piece of land. So we have, it's sort of combined with, we used obviously some land up in the golf course, but by changing the lot sizes, going from 10 up to here, we actually did keep the same number of lots, and it wasn't an abstract thing, it came to make sense. You know, we were putting some amenity in and squeezed the land up, and we still got what we wanted to do, because I think there was always a driver to actually keep a certain size community there. You know, it just works if it gets to a certain size. Obviously, we're going to talk about a little bit today, but I think I could wrap up my resort week, but we've always talked to as many of our neighbours as we can, and we were aware that there was an issue coming up on the Skipier Road in terms of the park and ride facility, and I mean, it's been good for us watching Real Juniors growing up on the lookout 4 years ago, but they have really boosted the activity out there, and I think they're looking ahead, perhaps with a longer term focus on the new owners and things. And so they're looking a lot harder. There was an incident, some of you may be aware of, where there was almost a civil disobedience thing here a couple of years ago to drive to Triple Cone, it was sharp and everyone went there, and they had to close the road because the capacity fuel of our season passes couldn't get up there, and they thought they should have been able to. So since then they've been addressing the whole area, they've extended the car parking at the Valley View, but they've also been looking hard at what they do here in terms of more of a park and ride in the longer term. And I think so we sat down with them and we were more than happy to try and create a zone there which facilitated a park and ride type facility. And it's good for us because if you're living here or staying here, walk or get a lift up to here and then you're up to the mountain. So I think it seemed to me one of the things the Commission has talked about is actually trying to connect the village to the mountain, and that this was one area that we could do it. So that's the other thing. So in terms of the gondola, just briefly, I think we've covered it quite a bit, but I mean, we really looked a couple of years ago at, you know, was it feasible? We got Blight upon us we got a survey done in conjunction with Skifield, and we realised that it was actually a two-stage operation. We've actually extended the car park in the ski area truck zone, and wiped the side where we had air alignment measuring 3.2k line, which is the maximum that they can practically do for a gondola. So that goes from that point to the point of that point, or whatever it was that you talked about, Warren talked about earlier. That goes to Skifield base, and if I had to take a guess, in 10 years, I think that will get built. Whether the link comes down to here, I think is probably slightly more problematical, but it's a possibility, and I think years ago we didn't think any of these things were going to happen, and they do happen. So sometimes when you look around the world, there are a lot more of these things than we have here. Certainly if they're going to keep your windows to the back, the skier numbers will jump a lot, and I think that would be quite a driver for more of a connection. So we provide the possibility of it, but really whether it happens, you know, we really don't know. And I think when you're creating a zone, you do need to look out and create the possibility of a number of things happening, even though you don't know exactly which will play out.
Don't be scared to think large.
Well, I mean, if you enable at the time, you know, it might happen. If you don't think ahead, then sometimes these things can happen. I think one of the last thing I was just talking about was really just what is the village going to be, and I think once again you don't quite know, but you know, I think we've been more specific than we were in the last iteration. We know that there's going to be a hotel is going to have obviously rather visitor accommodation business, but we think there will be residents who live there. I mean, I think obviously this doesn't replicate Millbrook, because a lot of things aren't the same as Millbrook. Millbrook's lot sizes go from 1,000 square metres to 3,000 square metres. Our lot sizes go from 800 to 250 or something like that. So it's really quite a different animal, and I think that would lead to obviously a lot wider accessibility for residents and visitors. So I think it will be a village where there will be a strong visitor accommodation heart, driving off the ski field, and there are other winter activities, and then the golf course in the summer, and all the other activities which operate in the district. And then I think being off that, there will be residents here. I mean, one thing I've seen personally is quite a few friends retiring to the district, and whereas in terms of, you know, moving outside of the district, and what we've got here is a wide range of lot sizes, which would actually open that up to quite a wide range of different people being able to live. And I think we'll have workers in more of the dense areas down here who work in the area. I mean, it's between Queenstown and Wellington, so you've got people who can actually live here and work in either location. So I think we'll end up being a wide range of different people. And once again, all we can do is actually try and facilitate through the planning rules, which we have done, and it started there, and we continue to really with pretty much the same format, just offering up the widest range of options we can, and ultimately the market will decide. When you create a zone, you know, it will take, you know, maybe 10 years to build out, so, you know, the market will move during that time, and you do need some flexibility.
Do you think the absentee ownership will be very similar to the rest of the region? Like, I suppose you've got 40% here.
I don't know, probably. Well, I don't know, 40% is the price here. We said it earlier, I don't know, but it's unlikely to be much of a problem.
question a number of us have asked you about this, is about staging. What would be your staging?
Well, the development set up, so obviously you've got to build the exposure here, and then the hotel and golf course would get built to start with, and then we've done a staging plan, which basically maybe puts that first, and some of that, and you basically just feed out along these routes. You've obviously got to create that link pretty early. So there's a sort of an option of extension through the zone.
Travel west.
Yeah.
Go this way.
There's a couple of key explainers, I think, of that. That's the problem.
You get the feeders, I think that's much easier.
That's right, yeah.
It hasn't been that kind of day for that. And I think it's sort of what you've described with the gondola, that you don't have particular issues to where it would be.
I think it's more likely to come in here.
Yes.
But once again, you know, hard to know. I think once again, we try to retain some flexibility. But certainly, the exercise we went through with Light and Palmer gave us a lot of clarity. I mean, we didn't really know whether it was one that would go the whole way, but they were pretty clear. It's got two different pieces, the top part. And if you think about it, you really don't want to have a gondola here with a car park where everyone is just going to drive up and so I think a two-stage gondola for me, when we finally got all the detail, that actually made sense. Mm-hmm. That's why we actually tried to consent a car park up there, so we had some more clarity on how to it might well be that one gets built and then another one gets built at the place.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think so that was why we were looking for a bit more information around that.
Yes.
None of us were particularly clear with the first lot of stuff we had, it's quite what was going to happen, and how you would accommodate your parking, for example. So, yeah. Okay. Any other questions?
No. Thank you. Again, this was a short summary statement there, which there was very briefly, and then between us, we'll go through the track change version of the provisions, just talk about the yellow highlighted bits, and then open the questions. So you can perhaps take your paragraph 1-3 as read, Mr. Brown, and start paragraph 4.
Thank you. I refer to and adopt my evidence for this hearing date the 26th of June and the assessment of the PEP stands at 32, both dated 6th December. My evidence in chief details the following matters: an overview of the background to the zone, a summary of the key changes to the zone being requested through the plan change, a comment on the higher order effect of the policies, assessment of the national policy statement on the development capacity, and assessment under part 2. And dependent copies of marked-up and clean versions of the zone and planning provisions as requested to be measured by the change. And I'm happy to answer any questions. So the provisions.
In terms of the track change, the latest track change version, which was September 30, Mr. Brown did this. And as I think you'll probably appreciate, the red editions were the original ones, then there's the blue. And the purple recommended by Mr. Hopefully your colours come out to say. Recommended by Mr. Bryce, and then yellow highlight for the latest one. So we're just going to touch on the yellow highlight ones.
So the first of those are in policy 2.3 on page 139C.
Just a slight wording change, commissioners. thought it would be useful to add in lighting, other lighting external to the buildings as well as street lighting. Sensible to talk about complementary commercial uses being limited to two, you might as well just say the two. But given that it's a parking area and there were summer activities, winter activities happening up there, just some other minor activities could be in sort of, just didn't seem to have to limit that. And the associated buildings was crossed out because buildings is already referred to, and that was just another one.
Oh, I see, because you've got buildings set up, a shuttle speed area, to kind of,
yes. The next page, 129Q, is also a double up. The yellow bits crossed out are actually covered by the first item under this list. The first item says buildings and activity area 6A approved pursuant to rule 1232236. And then the two that are crossed out are the two halves of 1222236. It's the recycling station and the gas storage facility service. The same thing was just in there twice. There's two or three elements in here which might be a jurisdictional issue, that they weren't requested. The questions are they consequential or not? And just like anything, you read these provisions for the 25th time, and on the 26th time, you spot something. So 139R, activity area 7, the last one is, in the current version, reads access during periods of the area is closed for grazing. If you're grazing, you probably want access to the farmer who's grazing it, or the tractor, or whatever. So the intention was public access during periods of the area was closed for grazing. And the second one is a bit of an oversight somewhere back. It says, currently says parking of vehicles and machinery at activity areas 6 and 7. And it originally said during and or. It's been taken out, so after construction. So it's anticipated that the vehicles and machinery activity areas 6 and 7 during construction, not afterwards. Now this is a prohibited activity. If you just then go back two pages, 139P, right hand column number Roman 4, this is discretionary activities. Access roads and car parking in figures 6 and 7 except roads identified as structure turn A, underground car parks, and road access and parking associated with the gondola. So it's actually intended that the gondola, if it ever happens, will be located in activity area 6 or 7, excluding the 6A that we talked about earlier. And obviously, the Gondola facility will have some degree of road access and parking associated with the Gondola. So it was deliberately excluded from the discretionary activity list to enable road access and parking associated with the Gondola. But then two pages over, 139R, parking of vehicles and machinery activity is 6 and 7 is prohibited activity. So it's just a basic inconsistency. So the point here is we're shifting from discretion to control as an ancillary or consequential change. The parking associated with the Gondola should be enabled from activity area 6 and 7. Bearing in mind that the whole thing is controlled. The whole thing, the Gondola activity, is a controlled activity, which with a number of control things including location. V, it's included the words that depict on structure plan V for consistency with other provisions. Maybe we're located within the mitigation planting and earthworks areas. That's just a quick word. Depicted on structure plan D. There's corrections there. The next page was an oversight. The operative structure plan B has, I think, 7 pipelines, and the replacement structure plan B has 4 or 5 pipelines. And the structure, the plan has changed, and the rule wasn't. So, look at structure plan. B has those height restriction lines, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of them. The operative plan has 9.
Right.
The height goes up and it's very complicated, so it's been reduced to 5. There's no material result. But the rule which relates to it, there were originally 9 steps, but come down to 5 steps. So those changes, since the changes on page 129W merely reflect the change to the structure plan.
And it doesn't mean that any buildings could be possibly higher than what they were. In fact, because it's gone from 1 metre increments down to 1 metre contours down to 2 metre contours, everything that's lower than one contour has to be at the height of the next lowest contour.
So slightly more restrictive.
Slightly more restrictive.
Really slightly more restrictive.
One of the questions that I had about, and I think somebody mentioned this earlier in the day, was how the Gondola base would fit into any of this, the heights. You'd have to have a base building, wouldn't you? So how would that fit into
the base? It wouldn't be, I think, yeah, it wouldn't be anywhere near those contoured areas on structure.
No.
It would be through the west. Yeah, the commercial area.
So if we were saying that the with this current table there, with your height on it, on someone on 39W, and if you were going to have the Gondola and activity areas 6 or 7, you don't have 7 on there, but 6 has a height of 4 metres.
Mm.
So that would be in conflict, basically. And you might need to have some sort of what would happen if it was in area 7. There is no area 7 there.
I think 7 was excluded. 7 was excluded because of the problem.
Right.
I think 6 probably should have been excluded too.
But if there, as per earlier conversation, if there is a, if we can further delineate Area 6 so that it's including a Gombra in some parts and excluding in others, then we need to take care of that height issue at the same time.
Just think of the
No, you're right, but...
Mr. Spence is just saying that it's likely that the base building will be in Area 1 anyway, which is 15 metres.
Right, okay. You might, I mean, when you do
your design,
you might
have to
tie it together a little bit more.
I don't think 6 was intended to be 4 metres, it wasn't
intended to be 5 metres. No.
No.
That's my, a lot of the information saying it's going to be in 6%, and it'll be at 1. So, it just needs, I just, if it's going to get controlled, which is what we want, then it's going to have to be a little bit more specific than you would have perhaps if it was an RDA or discretionary.
And in fact, it would be logical to exclude height, but make sure that height is included as a matter of control. Yes. Can you see the problem with this? 139X are all just tidy ups. Why left hand column just to tidy up bit of language. Right hand column at the top. It seems to make sense to actually put the data rather than the date 15 years from the date map train station sushi then becomes operative. Because of course what it really happened was becomes operative. It actually became operative on 8 December 2011. So it seems sense to put the data. Further down that column is just a matter of wording and clarity. And I suggest you write at the bottom, I suggest you having regard to the latest recommendations out of the report which is identified. If you have a minor corrections of numbering, then fuse that in. B. The phrase structures associated with the reach of the maintenance number probably includes buildings, but probably would be just better to actually specifically say buildings and structures. First change reflects an earlier one, widening the complementary commercial uses from the car park area. The second change, the crossed out little D is exactly the same, this is the assessor matter, the crossed out little D is exactly the same wording as the matter for discretion. See, the matter for discretion repeated in the assessor matter. To suggest an alternative wording, if D is the assessment matter, it's earlier, then E, the nature to which the proposed uses in buildings are ancillary to and complementary with the primary car park. So that's the assessment matter to assess whether you can have those associated uses. H, which is some tidy ups. One of the final pages, the new humour. This is just English language. I don't think it scores on the sky, I think it scores into the sky.
And the with the odd little word change like that, all of Mr. Price's suggested changes have been accepted.
Questions, please.
earlier on the time of the ESV regarding the policy 2.1 and the announcement space on page 139C. Thanks for the last line in that first column, particularly in visual problems such as the announcement space. I just wondered if it would be helpful to actually specify which activity area that is. Just for clarity, I know that some of the other policies specifically
refer
to activity areas, and I wondered if it would
benefit from scarf
space
within activity area
7A.
7A does cover these scarf spaces.
Yeah, My next question is similarly, I had a policy 2.7, and I asked Mr. Moore about the contouring and so on, and I wondered from a planning perspective how the cascade works here, how the rules are given effect to ensuring where practical the natural contours of the land are retained.
I can see your point, and in particular the reference in the policy to the naturalness or the natural content of the land. So it would be on page 12.1390 where there is a matter over the control risk reserve in respect of earthquakes.
And we have the controls around the tree. I believe it's been put in. Construction and maintenance of the golf course.
So that's the activity itself. And the, the maximum which,
I just wonder because it doesn't talk about the extent of the
interest
that if you decided to go for a rural park, like golf course or whatever the correct term is, that there's no limit really. So it's significant, some water spill or, as I say, for me, it governs the controlled activity and it's quite low.
Yes.
Or ensure that policy carries
through. So I think to answer that, it could be that there is another matter over which control is reserved on the right-hand column, page 1390, which talks about that.
And possibly an assessment now.
Yes.
So yes, we'll take it. We'll really do that.
The other thing was just to clarify for me, I heard earlier from Mr. Halliday about the future resource consent habitat assessments, and I wasn't clear from looking at the provisions that all business necessarily do require resource consent, so it was my understanding that only the ones within the activity area, so 1 and 5, and some of the other activity areas.
Yes, and various activities, particularly dwellings, are permitted activities,
yes.
But they have to go through the design guidelines and design review board.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be, it's more than likely at the building consent stage that the hazard issues will be assessed.
Okay, I was just taking what Hayes referred to the resource consent process.
I also think, and we will check, the kind of issues that Mr. Halliday was talking about, which were checking the protection and stability, is normally done at subdivision consent stage, not land use consent stage.
Well, that leads me to one of the questions actually is what would happen looking at these provisions if subdivision doesn't occur first, because they are actually pest control in the cost and provision, referring to the preparation of a management plan, and I was just trying to understand if a subdivision doesn't happen and land use went ahead in some areas, how these things would be addressed. Because you're right, normally they would be picked up a subdivision, which is what section 106 requires.
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially now that the X can win.
Perhaps we can say the party. I see two action points for us there. One, that I'm pretty sure they do, but to check the standard subdivision provisions do catch that. That's what we were relying on.
Yeah.
But you're right, we need to check that the subdivision doesn't come first, that it's the equivalent land use consent. Take that on board. We will address that.
I had a question too. It's looking at the original transplant date annual and changes to the transport provisions. And I know there's nothing to comment here, but there is still a reference to the signs, and I'm just wondering if there's any consequences of the impact that has been needed to the transport provisions. It does refer to the signs.
We did think about that, but we decided we didn't need to do anything. The only change to transport was on the connection point of the access road to the main Cadrona road.
Oh. The transport provisions of the standalone chapter automatically apply to the district wide chapter.
Oh, I realised that it's something that we refer to the zone, and I just sort of haven't got it somewhere, so I can't help them, I can't find it. I might come back to it.
Sorry, are you saying the transport section refers to the zone?
Yes, it does.
Oh, okay. Did it find it?
Yeah, I don't
know. I'll go off with that.
Probably need to check the box, which is maybe one there. We'll find it. Can we check that?
The changes before in regards to area 8C in the car park, and there's some words added in there about complementary commercial uses, and you've removed the word limiting it to the change. I'm not fully familiar with the definitions in the plan. Does it have a definition of complementary or ancillary? I'm aware that some other plans do have definitions. That's true.
Don't think so.
Because it just says to me, perhaps it's unprecise to have a rule. There's a bit of judgment in there as to what complementary.
That was intended. Because you can't anticipate what might or mightn't be complementary.
I just wondered, which is the lawfulness of how do you know that that rule applies if you don't know, you know what complementary. That's a bit of a circular argument, isn't it? I mean, you want flexibility, but the rules may stand on their own without interpretation.
Ancillary?
Ancillary?
I think ancillary is defined.
That would be the plan. What I'm wondering is,
well, I think it's defined in relation to
building. Or government that it's discretionary and it's especially
intention of trying to look back to what the intent of what the area is for. Ancillary might help.
Ancillary on its own is the point. There's ancillary commercial activities and ancillary
retail. Ancillary retail or ancillary commercial activities defined, but not ancillary on its own.
Then we stick with the definition of the rules.
Well, or even they have some sort of footnote that might help to put a bit of context around it.
Okay. So turning down the subdivision, well, those are subject to my earlier questions, and the on the first page at the bottom at Mount Drone and Sack Special Zone, first clause by, talks about a carbon being registered on each title, requiring those to get against the design of the board. And I was wondering how that process would take over if that's the subdivision for the first decision, and what the mechanics of that would be. So whilst you're not changing that, I wonder how it works.
Design review as well as hazard.
Mm.
Yes.
So just a brief story. And that's all I have. Thank you.
I have a very simple question. Under the 42A report, the suggestion that to the area 6 that one recycling station would be at 0%, is going to be enough for the total village? Just out of interest, didn't seem a lot to me. In other words, would it be bigger than what you might envisage for one station each?
Well, given that recycling is usually part of, you take stuff somewhere so the rubbish truck can get it together, so the rubbish truck can pick it up.
622 miles, yeah. I just wonder whether one station is going to be enough. Yeah.
Well, there's one transfer station in Queenstown, the whole of Queenstown.
You're true, but this is not going to be a transfer
station. I don't have a transfer station.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was just a thought.
Mm. And usually with gas, it's usually one. Yes, they usually can send one tank that can feed everything. They don't usually have it scattered around. It's like,
no, that's another question. I'm assuming it's one big tank.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you'll have a guess, I'm assuming it's going to be a big tank.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing.
I just had a few questions around some of the specifics, but a couple of general questions first. Are you aware of any changes to the proposed RDS that we need to be particularly aware of as far as that stands at the moment? You know, my understanding is that, you know, there's extensive hearings, there's decisions, there are appeals. I have heard that a lot of the appeals are pretty much being settled, but there's nothing come out of court yet. Am I correct?
Well, I'm going to defer to my learned counsel on my left, who's right. Sitting in the mediation and stuff. Yeah.
I mean, that's what I've heard from the court on a number of other matters I'm dealing with. So, have they pretty much been mediated, or what's the rest of that?
We've just received the council's reply from mediation yesterday, and all parties are reporting back to the court this Friday. Right. And at this stage, it's looking like all of the Land Act provisions are settled. So that's certainly of relevance.
Mm.
It's looking like the only matter outstanding will be in relation to regionally or nationally significant infrastructure provisions. So there's a high degree of confidence between parties and council that everything will be resolved through mediation fairly promptly. Not from the provisions that have been set by the ground.
My question to was anything relevant to this hearing that you can think of?
No, well I had questions because it came up another hearing I had about 3 months ago. One of the points that the council, regional council, proposed in its recomposed statement was the word avoid with natural hazard, which was appealed by multitudes, of course. Where did that get to?
My understanding is that all use of the term avoidance if the term avoid has been retained, it's not been retained in an unqualified manner.
Right.
It's been, in some instances, for example, avoid significant adverse effects or otherwise remedy or mitigate as appropriate. That's all been qualified subsequent to the appeal process because so many parties, including all the territorial authorities almost, because the District Council, Dunedin, the City Council, Queensland Act, all opposed the use of the avoidance term without qualification.
So
what legal weight are we providing on these at the moment? Given they're just poised to go to court, but the court hasn't seen it yet, I take it. Well, it's what they are responding out to, so.
No, the court hasn't seen a revised set of the art yet.
No.
Submitted. So, it's stated in the legal submissions, so I consider that the proposed art yet should be given relatively low weighting, given it's in a state of flux. It must be kept in regard to within section 75, which, you know, the case will see the decision maker should give genuine attention and thought to, but may then move on as required.
Mm-hmm.
So I think given the breadth of appeals, it would be unsafe to place too much more weight on that.
Well, we leave back to the decision version, basically.
Yes.
That's where we've got to stand there.
The transport, by the way, the reference in the transport section to the back of the space is about on-site parking. We'll be able to back you ask Mr. Ross if he's got any comments on that on that provision.
Okay, thank you. The next question might be a little bit surprised when I ask this one. This is to do with golf course and the potential, well, there will be a use of fertilizers that's mentioned earlier today. And the effect of that on the river. And I know you're probably going to say to yourself, why is she asking that question? That's a regional council matter. I'm thinking of it more in the context of the NPS freshwater management, which requires integrated management. So, in my head, you're having to look at what the effect of the fertilizers would be coming from the land use going into the river. And I just wondered if you've given me a thought on that.
No, I haven't thought about that. My automatic answer, I think, would be that there's quite, well, we're on the top of the escarpment, you know, there's quite a drop, there's quite a lot of space in between there and the river, including the road, which has got big swales either side, so there'd be quite a lot of intersecting going on. I would think it would be improbable that anything would be leaching down through groundwater sources to get back and into the river, but I'm not qualified on that sort of thing. That
who would send your team would be able to answer that question?
It probably would have been Mr.
The
ecologist. Is there a ecologist? Neil Simpson. All the contamination.
Can you leave us with that question?
Yeah.
Can I just comment? My recollection, the mention of fertiliser that you said to was Mr. Moore saying you either have the standard park like golf courses with lots of chemicals and fertiliser, or you have the alpine winter courses.
Mm.
And we talked about grass that grew naturally here, so I'm actually not sure that is an issue, but I'm not sure.
Well, I think he said things that his report, well, he seemed to say two things to me. That was one of them. And then at some point along the way, he also said there are less fertilizers on the lake. So I thought, he'd answer the question, because most golf courses, especially up there, I think they require some fertilizer. So anyway, could you just turn your mind to that?
Absolutely.
Now, this is a question relating to page 139. And that version of the bottom we were discussing earlier, number 7.
Mm-hmm.
Just from here, If you're going to widen that out a little bit and have other activities that might be, let's say, ancillary, we'll use that word at the moment, what height control does that apply to anything here? Because I think we've got somewhere else a reference to there shall be no more than total door area of 400 square metres on this part, but there's nothing about height.
4.5 is the height, and that's the zone standard on page 139W.
That is a table we're just looking
at. Yes, yes.
Awesome. And now 139X is an occupation there. And this relates to your noise limits. So I'm on the right side of the page particularly. And I just wondered if you give any thought in there to commercial recreation activities. It seems to be sort of quoting to me the potential. It's just not terribly detailed, and I asked some questions about it earlier. But let's just play this thing out and we find that this thing takes off and people will want to come to Cadrona all of a sudden for other things. And one of the activities, for example, that might establish or seek to establish the evidence, Mr. Goldsmith and I had a wrangle about a few years ago, was go-karting. So I'm just playing out a worst-case scenario, intentionally. But there's nothing in there that particularly applies to an activity like that. And I just, it would fit within a commercial recreation activity. So, I had something else in common, I don't know if you need to answer it right now.
Well, in the activity areas 1, 2, 3, 4, there's limits there that would apply to anything.
Yeah.
Well,
doesn't the commercial recreation activity in there apply?
Yes. Good question, and probably another little bit of homework for us.
The advantage for us is we were looking at it for the first time, not the 100th time, so you can see this thing. That was all I had. Anything else has been covered then. So.
Thank you very much.
And if there's anything else that comes up, we'll let you know. But sometimes you go back and see something as you have done, and you can tell yourself. Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Thank you.
All right.
Just a place, okay.
Sorry, I just wanted to clarify one point that we discussed this morning, which was the question about whether any of the resource legislation of Emmett Bill or Act now kind of were relevant. And I've just had the opportunity to check my answer, and I confirm that the new fraction of territorial authorities is in effect now. In section 31AA, it reads, the establishment, implementation and review of objectives, policies and methods to ensure that there is sufficient development capacity in respect of housing and business land to meet the expected demands of the district. But I've also checked the Act and the transitional savings and related provisions, which doesn't change my earlier answer, and that it reads that the proposed, in respect to proposed policy statements or changes to plans or variations, the proposed policy statement plan change or variation must be determined as if the amendments made by the Amendment of an Act had not been enacted. That doesn't change. So the previous section 31 requirements remain the same as when the before the resource legislation and then the Act came into force post TC 52 being publicly notified.
And also just remember that there was some reference made to something being tabled by somebody from Heritage, which we haven't seen. Somebody gives a copy and happy to look at it while I'm
just about to say it. Yes, it was received just about
29th
June.
Somebody can comment on
it. We might want to look at it before you wrap up your presentation.
I think we agree with those amendments anyway, so not that. And that's the case for a question.
Thank you very much. Now, we might just take 5 or 10 minutes to stretch our legs and take some advice on what we've done for the last 90. So the next, we're going to submit as next for those in the room who join us. And we've got these fellows who are going to find the building first. Yes. Any problems? Right. Okay. We'll have you in just a few minutes, okay?